very much for this very generous introduction. Too generous, probably, as we will see in my paper very soon. And thank you very much for the invitation. Able to be part of this working group related to the conference was really a huge luxury. I learned so much, and the intellectual generosity of everybody involved is just mind-blowing. So, one structural thing about my paper is you're going to see the quotes in German, and you're going to hear the quotes in English. So I'm going to always read it out in English, but the original will be on the screen there. The only exception is Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, because I couldn't find my German edition, because I moved last week. So Hegel is in English, but it's his problem, maybe. So let's get started. These unhappy intellectuals, are they dangerous? They are, as cigars, which one cuts into the soup. The intellectuals, or to stay in Brecht's image, the cigars, are unhappy, and rightfully so. But their well-being is clearly not Brecht's concern. Neither is it mine, involved or not. It's rather their toxic and viral contamination of life that troubled Brecht as much as it should trouble us. In what is to follow, I will thus focus on exactly this viral toxicity of the intellectuals. This is to attempt an actualized reading of what Brecht, in his Tui Romanfragment from the 1930s, and Karl Einstein, in his equally incomplete, or rather equally struggling, Fabrikation der Fiktion of the same period, which we already heard about a lot here and there in the conference, sketched out. Brecht, as will be demonstrated, even more so Einstein, were aiming at a self-defacing of intellectualism by defaming its modern origin as surplus life, cigars. In Brecht's case, this defamation is not least a critique of ethics. As he asserts in one of the introductory fragments under the heading Lehrstoffe, syllabus, one does not need to be bribed into a non-guilt verdict of oneself, end quote. An ethical problem that is solved by the TUIs in thinking of themselves as the bearers of truth. So their self-discharge is categorical. The syllabus in the text is consequently preceded by their Hauptlehre, guiding principle, consciousness determines being, which is, of course, an inversion of Marx's famous being determines consciousness. To characterize the TUI, Brecht employs a very specific grouping of aesthetic means, mainly readapted figures from Chinese theater, which will also return as a major means in Brecht's later version, the Turandot, the Congress der Weißwäscher, of 1954. Brecht got more and more invested in these forms in the early 30s, while working on the TUI fragments when in 1935, and we saw him earlier in a picture, he saw the legendary Chinese actor Mei Lang Fang perform in Moscow and later also met with him. On the basis of this contact, Brecht regenerated his understanding of the V effect, the estrangement effect. His notes from this meeting summarize the principle of Mei Lang Fang's means in Brecht's understanding. And I just translated a couple of examples. For example, technique not entirely conflated with content and no immediate impact, knowledge necessary, or the player gift not just agreed at the register, but each time again in the play. What Brecht sketches out here is not just a list of theatrical means, but also a space in which to deviate from ideological or, in Einstein's wording, fictitious conscience. Brecht makes room for revolutionary voluntarism. Mei Lang Fang's own four stylized and meticulously articulated physical registers of play, chant and gesture, speech and acrobatics, however, are all but modern, acting within the tradition of the Peking opera. In the TUI fragments, which are not a play, but one might say rather a milieu study, an ethnographic fieldwork, Brecht not only uses Chinese names and tropes from Chinese theater, but converts specifically one of its experiential effects, the processual resistance between technique and content, to establish the TUI's inadequacy to the lives they contaminate. The fragments are subdivided into larger chapters. So, major lines, viewpoints and plans, four journeys, TUIs and TUI schools, the Golden Age of the TUIs, further takes on the history of the TUI Republic, demise and end of the TUI stories. So you see, it is a fieldwork. Brecht moves from the external observation of principles to a historicization, which explains the rise of this civilization and a record of its demise. But for all the self-implying humor in these fragments, the Brecht self-implication remains scant. Brecht exports Mai Lang Fang's registers to European and more specifically to Christian clerical categories to historicize the rise and ancestry of the TUIs, to thus identify them with the previous historical bearers of ideology, the priests. In characterizing the TUIs with schemata lifted from Chinese theater, Brecht's usage of the clerical insignia become infinitely more poignant because the social isolation which professionalized intellectualism in Brecht's times, as much as in our own, is entitled to, is consequently rendered as essentially esoteric and comically pathological even. Its modern metaphysical lineage is effectively demonstrated as dematerializing and detemporalizing, which we already heard a lot about in the previous section. And what remains of the TUI is only their material, the capitalist status as surplus. They are unproductive. The TUI is, in Brecht's own opening definition, the intellectual of this time of the markets and commodities, the renter of his intellect. In his late drafts on theories of surplus value, published in 1851, Karl Marx had already argued that, and I quote Marx, "The antagonisms within material production necessitate a superstructure of ideological status groups." And as Wolfgang Fritz Hauck has demonstrated, this is quite precisely what Brecht situates the TUI. Brecht's TUIs are an effect of capital. Their metaphysical leanings are but an ideological haze, and their inclinations towards criticality are only other than purely self-referential, or one might say religious, where they become what Brecht deemed himself to be, an interfering thinker, eingreifender Denker. And this is exactly where Einstein's theoretical polemic, Fabrikation der Fiktion, comes into play. Not only, as Heidemarie Oehm has introduced it, as a like-minded infective against the enforced social degeneration of intellectualism in the 30s, but also as a counterpoint to Brecht's Marxist materialism. That Hauck discusses the TUI fragment in the vein of a Leninist and Gramscian Marxism, or that the GDR Brecht scholar Werner Mittenzweig argues that the form of this fragment is lastly one of a Lehrstück, seems all but construed. And as much as this is founded on their own political tendentiousness, it is also founded on Brecht's own. And it's not that Einstein's polemics aren't tendentious, or for that matter that they aren't materialist. But what here, and here it becomes apparent that Brecht in the end only serves me as a foil to pinpoint what I would see as the political pitfalls of modernist Marxism and the cultural voluntarism it implies, Einstein's equally polemic dissection of the intellectualism of this time stages anti-capitalism, or rather the decapitalization of life, as a necessary revolutionary realignment of materialism itself. In Einstein's late writings, materialism, as counterintuitive as this might at first glance sound, cannot be determined by capital. It cannot be an effect of what it seeks to abolish. In Fabrikation der Fiktion, Einstein sets out to lay the theoretical groundwork for what we, here in the show, see as the guiding principle of a revised history of art, Einstein's unfinished Handbuch der Kunst. And I will proceed to argue that the incompleteness of the Fabrikation der Fiktion is, in a strong sense, necessitated by its argumentation, that it traces the configurations of a materialism that cannot conclude itself within the fictitious reality of late capitalism's imperialist and colonial idealism, because its dynamic is not least that of a multi-layered self-abolition. Fabrikation der Fiktion is a realignment of materialism against idealism, and that means not least a realignment of materialism against the very figure of idealism which in Brecht, and also in Marx and Lenin, remains untouched. Because Einstein's materialism is directed, Einstein's late materialism. This is what I concentrate on. Because in earlier, like in writings around 1919, you have much more like, more proto-pseudo-Marxist, Leninist sounding things. But not here. So because Einstein's materialism is directed against the Kantian, the Hegelian, the Marxian modern subject, the I, which I will return to. And as it is the intellectual, the artist, and the philosopher who are the self-professed modern ideal embodiments of this subject form till this very day, these are Einstein's systematic targets. Where Brecht's polemic against the TUI as the renter of his intellect appeals to voluntaristic solution, it draws out a situation in which the alienation and objectification of the professionalized intellect in capitalist societies can be effectively overcome by the materialist readjustment of one's truth claim. So if the measure of one's intellectual reflections is no longer their exchangeability, their malleability, and thus their marketability in accordance to their disidentification with the production of use value, if intellectuals, in other words, turned their capitalization on the productive labor of others, into establishing their own use value for the bearers of this labor, e.g. the working class, then they'd be socialized in Brecht's terms. Differently put, the problem about the aim for an affirmative understanding of the working class is their own emanation from capital. And even though Brecht, as much as, for example, Walter Benjamin, of course noted this, he still founded his claim for revolutionary change on the capitalist isolation of productive labor that had manufactured the working class and isolated it. Property is to be abolished where it concerns the alienation of individual and collective labor, but it is legitimized where it characterizes the subject's own voluntaristic properties. Voluntaristic self-alienation is affirmed as an emancipatory process or as the process of individual emancipation. What Marx maps out as abstract labor, with Marx, here rightfully comes under attack. But what Hegel before him introduced as individual work does not. And here comes Hegel in English. Work is of all and for all. Only here does the individual have existence as individual. Prior to this, the individual is merely something abstract, untrue as a concept. End quote. It is this order, the separation of abstraction and concretion, the limitation of materialism into a realized idealism, which also lies at the core of Hegelian Marxism, and which, in Einstein's Fabrikation der Fiktion, is not shared. Einstein picks a series of central tropes from aesthetic as much as from political theory, which he, in Fabrikation der Fiktion, again and again takes apart exemplarily, demonstrating their idealist function and genesis. One of these figures, for example, a very prominent one, is the metaphor, which he characterizes as an archaism. And funnily and tellingly, Susanne Leeb already used the parts of the very same quote, which I'm now going to use too, and Tom also referred to it this morning, so this is a very popular quote. The metaphorical strings contain another archaism. The different conditions and things slip into one another and are evaluated evenly. One sign can replace the other randomly. And so the mana wanders serenely from humans into things, from animals into stones. A similar neutralization of concrete things or persona is administered by the capitalist. He defigures humans and objects by the means of abstract money, which is his mana. Poets and capitalists are dynamists and are seeking out a maximum of mobility. End quote. It's really warm in here. In attacking the role of metaphor in modern thought, and Einstein returns to this in relation to philosopher and artists too, so here we have capitalists and poets, and on other occasions we have philosophers and artists. Einstein here sees this, the idealism, which is contained in such metaphorical adaptations of Capital's self-representation, as an idealism. What Marx in the first volume of Capital termed the appearance of Capital as an automatic subject, a perpetuum mobile of its own making. So where the metaphor contents itself of refiguring capital and thereby making it visible. If one, for example, looks at the critique of capital in virtual, like or in lots of contemporary art theories, you will see that they are interspersed with such metaphors of capital, the most popular still being cultural capital. But in Einstein's view, at the same time, this reinstates this metaphorical use of capital. In Einstein's view, this reinstates capital's idealism of absolute exchangeability, an ongoing dematerialization of metamorphotic life as infinitely equalized in figures of idealism. And another trope he uses very often to discredit things is dualism, which I can return to later maybe, because it also came up earlier. So Einstein does thus effectively refuse to distinguish between the critical and the affirmative use of a category. And one could demonstrate this in many other cases too, like with dualism, for example. He instead argues for the need of an affirmative and thereby metamorphotic materialism, I would say, which hands itself over to the transfigurations, the transen, which he turns into a verb, trance of matter, human or not. And again, one can see in the exhibition in how far this is exactly what the Handbuch der Kunst effectively does, envisaging a system of affirmative categories. Einstein's excessive use of variations of the word trance, for example, which reaches from transaction to trance, hereby gains a transmutated meaning, because the transactions themselves, the process which I just quoted as capitalist and which makes all matter indistinguishable as capital, from a different vantage point suddenly becomes metamorphotic, because it doesn't work. I mean, capitalism doesn't work. The idealism which capitalism has of itself is not its material existence. The metabolism of humanity with nature, which Hegel describes as the formative process of the subject in being rendered metamorphotic by Einstein, unbridles. I don't know if you can actually turn this into a verb, but it becomes transformational, it transmutates. Einstein's Fabrikation der Fiktion, in that sense, is not least a critique of capital as a failed human synthesis, a series of idealist fictions that overcasts a failed life, like the one Jenny was talking about, or rather a life continuously doomed to fail, to brutalize, to be shortcut, misguided by its necessarily toxic attempts to adapt to modern individuality. The I of idealism comes into view not just as someone with an appetite for capital recognition, but the intellectuals in this perspective are much more than a harmful effect of the monetarization of intellectual labor. Their intellect itself is, in its very form, the reason for the suppression of life. For Einstein, the Hegelian concept of emancipation by work, the individualization that proceeds by appropriation and negation of what is externalized as not I, is in itself unacceptable. To circumvent this vanity of negation, Eitelkeit der Negation, as Einstein calls it, results for Einstein, in accordance to his own present, as Sibylle Penkert has argued, ultimately in a, and I quote her, a permanent failure as process of production, end quote. A materialization of the present that is in need of an, and another quote from Einstein, owed to the collapse of the substances which hold him, and thereby the otherness of the human in the world. Without holding, collapse of the fixated anthropomorphism. Thereby Einstein's love for immediacy, another word which keeps returning in the Fabrikation der Fiktion, which from today's thinking habit at first seems vaguely romanticist, but is in fact quite the opposite. While Einstein again and again invokes immediacy as an alternative to truth, he adapts to counter the psychic class division, psychische Klassenteilung, which the virtuosos of fractioning, die Spaltungsvirtuosen, über die er immer wieder schreibt, on the left, are unwillingly orchestrating just as much as the capitalism which gave them their form. Einstein, and Anselm already referred to this in his introduction yesterday, does not aspire to pull through, as he writes in a letter to his friend Ewald Wasmuth, of which other letters which is quoted by Charles Haxhausen. And I quote this letter, and I quote actually like the part which comes after what was just quoted. One, so by the end of this show, you will have the full letter. So. One writes and calculates at the same time how and if, and we have it in German, One writes and calculates at the same time how and if one is to pull through. One will certainly not, if the crisis is a permanent condition, which seems probable to me. End quote. The impossibility to pull through, or to use Haxhausen's translation, to survive, in writing as much as in life, is enforced by the Fabrikation der Fiktion, by the intellectual reinforcement of capital's idealism as the idealism of the intellect, within which there is no sublation, as Hegel had envisaged it, but only a series of critical escapisms, as which Einstein marks those colonial and imperialist metaphoric fake immediacy that he sees in aesthetic primitivism as much as in the Leninist adorations of the working class. Where the collective appears in Einstein's writing, and it appears a lot, Fabrikation der Fiktion, this working class is not identified by profession, but by collective and collectivizing metamorphosis, by deviational metabolism. The working class in Einstein's perspective is not identified by their productive labor, but by their metamorphotic qualities that rise from their fictitious capitalist arrangement as generators of use value. And this is not pretty. Specifically, when the working class has ceased working and becomes an unworked class, as more and more significantly socially within financialized capitalism. And to wake you all up, and to give this argument a bit more of a contemporary traction, I want to not really much more than hint to the recent work of the Berlin-based and Zwickau-born artist Henrike Naumann and her current exhibition 2000, on view at Museum Abteiberg Mönchengladbach. This show, and this is the poster for it, but I'll stay with it for a second. The show brings together a combination of Naumann's works of the last years, video and sound work within a somewhat pastoral landscape of furniture, period pieces of the 90s, which are presented on a cheap-looking 80s pattern carpet, which is basically what you see here, cut out in the form of the national borders of West and East Germany of 1989. Naumann, in her work, does address not collectivity, but Gemeinschaft, which is arrested within a fictitious, within a fictitious life that materializes in habitus, in Nazi habitus. Naumann's works are milieus, the materialism of a fictitious life into the sceneries of which the viewer is forced. So you sit in those lovely chairs and so forth to watch films, one of which I will shortly mention. One of Naumann's videos, for example, and this is the one you would see on the right, is called The Reich, and it's about the Reichsbürger, a militant group by now around 5,000 people all over Germany, armed people, who print their own IDs because they denounce the German state as an illegitimate state on the grounds of the Grundgesetz of 1949, which they refute. So they call themselves Reichsbürger and have their own passports. And Naumann does not document them. She does not explain what the Reichsbürgers are, but she assembles and visually overlays YouTube videos which Reichsbürger posted of themselves, standing their grounds against the German police, mostly. So we have modern subjects out of labor, not productivity, no Innerlichkeit, but all the racism, sexism, and brutalism of a modern subject void of idealism. So when you keep the Hegelian subject form but leave no trace of progress, I would say then you're an installation by Henrike Naumann. So this is merely me pointing in Naumann's direction and saying, look. But if we think of Einstein's insistence against idealism, Naumann's work figures as a contemporary aesthetic practice which does not engage in idealism of political art, nor does she engage in the idealism of the subject which voluntaristically should just change its efforts. So this is not critically educational, but it demonstrates the metamorphotic qualities of today's Fabrikation der Fiktion in all its viral toxicity. The metamorphotical in Einstein, as in Naumann, is not a sight for sore eyes, but in Naumann's case, the generation of what was formerly the GDR into a landscape of brutalized unproductivity, the casting of a social collective in the ideological negative, the rise of groups like the National Socialist Underground from a collective youth culture of upended nationalized idealism. Thus, there is a second respect in which Einstein's materialism is not an idealism. The temporality it gives rise to is an experiential one. Einstein cannot pull through or survive because the metamorphotic reality he builds up against the Fabrikation der Fiktion is disintegrating his very own form. Like was mentioned in the discussion earlier, Einstein is disintegrating himself. The form of the intellectual is what he disintegrates because, and Einstein is very clear in that, and I repeat myself here, the intellectual is not a secondary effect of capital's idealism, but he is the main profiteer and genuine productive force of it. It is, unlike in Brecht's TUI fragment, not the content of intellectual labor that makes its form toxic, sadly, but it is the form of the intellect itself that renders all of its content as practically a lie, which is why Karin Zellow rightfully remarks that Einstein's critique of ideology effectively returns to this motive's medieval form, also invoked famously by Nietzsche, of course, the Priestertrug. And I have absolutely no idea what this is in English. Maybe one of you does. Priestertrug, yeah. Well, Priestertrug, I don't know. Intellectual labor is the idealist form. It is the brutalization, the dematerialization, the detemporalization, the making exchangeable of life. And if one does not want to give this system of fictions the courtesy to call it an ideology, which Einstein clearly does not, it ends of being a mere set of lies. And furthering a remark by Karin Zellow, I want to end this talk by briefly pointing to the source of Einstein's materialism, which arguably lies in his studying of the work of Ernst Mach in Berlin early on between 1904 and 1908. Who was Mach? Who was foundational not only for Alexander Bogdanov's anti-Leninist monist Marxism, but also for writers like Robert Musil, who wrote his PhD about Mach, for someone like Pierre Klosowski, and for the other Einstein, Albert. I do not have the time here to go into Mach's work in detail or at length or in any appropriate form, but Mach's The Analysis of Sensation and the Relation of the Physical to the Psychical, a book of 1883, which was reprinted in numerous editions until 1916, reappears in Einstein's writings again and again. Not so much in direct quotes, but in Mach's central insight from the book, or in a series of Mach's central insights from that book, which Einstein in Fabrikation der Fiktion lays out in its consequences. The most pop one being, the I is unsalvageable. Das Ich ist unrettbar. Mach's theory is one of physical experience, in which production and reception are not categorically distinct, but give way to a materialist empiricism. And this is, of course, why Bogdanov went for it. And it is from Mach that Einstein, in the Fabrikation der Fiktion, imports the other slightly uncanny category, which often appears together with that of immediacy, namely the biological. But again, if one considers that Einstein uses both immediacy and its different variations, as well as biology and its different variations, as replacements of the concept of idealistic truth, and more importantly, if one considers that Einstein aims not least at refiguring the bearer of this truth, the individual, then the biological gains a metamorphotic quality, because all naturalism is rendered fictitious, like all naturalism within capital is rendered fictitious. To refer to the biological as the presence of vitality only becomes problematic within an idealist register that has already christened the European modern idealist subject as the naturalized human form in and of itself. If it becomes the guiding principle of what is termed biology, then we're left with all that Nazism, which Henrike Naumann stages as the enforced youth culture of unproductiveness. But when being re-envisioned as a foundational and more than anything else a collective or collectivizing category of those metamorphotic immediacies which are shooting up amidst the Fabrikation der Fiktion, then the biology that runs through the limbs of fiction is an unsettling vitality that, as of now, cannot pull through. This is not a critical model, but a metamorphotic desire. And there are large passages about eroticism in the book, inevitably, and also about guilt. But again, and like in Naumann, this guilt is not a category of ethics. It is not the entrance point of a critical distance from one's own guilt, but it is its material embracement. Thus, my using the formulation of self-abolition in the beginning, Einstein abolishes himself as an intellectual by writing the Fabrikation der Fiktion to from there propose a Handbuch der Kunst, the metamorphotic registers of which are envisioning another temporality from art, and go on, and which one has to fight, and which he goes on fighting in the Dorothy column, because fascism will not end itself, and still it hasn't. So I want to close this talk with a passage from a poem, another piece of contemporaneity to demonstrate, or rather predicate, the poignant actuality of Einstein's anti-idealist materialism. And for that, I want to return to my first Einstein quote, the popular one. And I will read it out once again because it's so great. The metaphorical strings contain another archaism. The different conditions and things slip into one another and are evaluated evenly. One sign can replace the other randomly. And so the mana wanders serenely from humans into things, from animals into stones. A similar neutralization of concrete things or persona is administered by capitalists, by the capitalist. He defigures humans and objects by the means of abstract money, which is his mana. Poets and capitalists are dynamists and are seeking out a maximum of mobility. Here they are, the poets, capitalists in their own accord. And the poet I want to quote, David Buck, who lives in Oakland and whose work of the last years has strongly worked through the events around the Oakland riots and the Oakland general strike that effectively shut down the port of Oakland in the beginning of November of 2011. Buck, however, does not narrativize these events at any point. They are not being brought into a definite historical form. He does not restage what briefly ensued in Oakland as a now literary moment of past glory or defeat. There is nothing heroic in Buck's dealings with the prose of those times and him turning them into his poetry. There is, however, a certain heroism that is addressed as having a life outside of a language, but that heroism is forced to appear as life's effective derealization repeatedly in Buck's books, just as it is in Einstein's Fabrikation der Fiktion. The struggle for the discontinuation of that system here becomes poetically bound up with our own struggle to continue in a mode of discontinuing, in a mode of de-disciplining. It is a struggle not least for our own discontinuation, a struggle against our future, or rather against our present futurity. Thank you.